Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, right out of the box, as I sat down at the board, I noticed that I had an email. Let me respond to Martha, who had a question, a little truncated here. Dear Dr. Dawn, I heard you recommend colloidal silver for chronic sinusitis. I have a family member who is highly allergic to mold. And then the question truncates, but I imagine it was just at maybe the very end of the show. And so it came in when I was already wrapping up. So, Martha, a week late, but hopefully still in time for your friend. Colloidal silver is a very good antibacterial and anti-mold, and it's quite benign and non-dangerous for humans. You could, in fact, take a bath in it. What I don't recommend is drinking lots of it every day because it's not great for your microbiome. The only quote-unquote known disease that you get from drinking vast amounts of silver is colloidal silver is that you turn blue, which might get you a job as an extra in a Marvel movie, but for the most part it's really not a pretty bright blue. It's kind of a grayish blue, sort of, you know, old robot blue. It's not pretty enough, I think, to do as a creative gesture of the defiance for the, you know, the whole fixation on skin color. Why not be blue? Why not be a purple people eater for that matter? Well, because cannibalism, not so good. Anyway, I am getting just a little bit out in left field here. Martha, I highly recommend it for prevention of both viral infections. Use it myself on airplanes. I see no problem with your highly mold allergic friend using it. But from the standpoint of mold allergies, I have to emphasize that the mold spores are being breathed in and causing an allergic reaction. And that allergic reaction is not because the mold got into the sinuses and is growing there. Now, I mean, you could have mold allergies and have no mold growing in your sinus because your immune system is working well. In fact, a little too well, because you're having these allergic reactions to the mold. So, it might be useful for your friend, but I would also suggest that maybe using a neti pot, an Ayurvedic thing where you rinse out your sinuses on a regular basis. And of course, emphasizing the difference between a mold allergy and mold toxins, which that's not an allergic reaction, has nothing to do with IgE, isn't helped with steroids. And in people who are sensitive to mold toxins can be very, very serious because it poisons the mitochondria. So hopefully your friend just has mold allergies. Believe me, that is the better of the options that are there. I thought I would start out this week by addressing one of the fundamentals that I intend, and as the residency program in family medicine gets rolling, to make sure that the doctors that we train here have a better sense for exactly how to counsel people and not just hand them a prescription for a sleeping pill. It's not that I'm against sleeping pills like Ambien or, the myriad of ones. I'm sort of against the over-the-counter ones largely because they contain antihistamines and can have a prolonged effect. I like short-acting sleep aids. Usually people need to either get to sleep or get back to sleep. So I like things like, you know, plain Zolpidem, which is plain non-extended release Ambien at a very, very low dose, 2.5 milligrams, something like that, to just put under the tongue, get yourself to fall asleep. And if you wake up from a hot flash, you know, us perimenopausal or menopausal women often do, another one of those under the tongue at, say, 3 in the morning will have worn off by 7 when you need to get up. People who have all those weird side effects from Ambien, of course, Zolpidem, should not follow this advice. But the same thing is true of many of the prescription sleeping aids. I'm very fond of Lunesta, which I think is a very clean drug. It gives you a bad taste in the mouth, so it has a bad reputation. But personally, I'm hoping you brush your teeth in the morning, and that should take care of any bad taste. Now, let's talk about some non-drug strategies that I think are much healthier. And a lot of it has to do with not just what to do, but what not to do. So let's talk about avoiding stimulants. This seems pretty obvious, but many people don't realize that their dessert may in fact contain stimulants. You need to read the labels. A lot of desserts will contain coffee or chocolate, and those are stimulants. They contain the theobromines, which are related, and they also contain caffeine. And of course, teas, coffees, Pepsi, Coke, Mountain Dew, these are all stimulants. So if you have trouble sleeping, you really don't want to have anything after 12 noon, because in many of us, it takes that long to break it down. If you're a postmenopausal woman, your time to break it down may actually be more like 16 hours. So you really need to be careful to only consume these things in the first 4 hours of your sleep-wake cycle. Obviously, or maybe not so obviously to people, alcohol actually interferes with sleep. Alcohol is going to reduce the breakdown of orexin. It interferes with the enzyme that breaks down the stay-awake hormone. So even though people can become drowsy on alcohol, as that drowsiness wears up and they wake up, their wake hormone is still there in the middle of the night when it shouldn't be. It should have been shut down, but because that shutdown has been prevented, it's still present in the system, and the effect is not being able to sleep or only being able to fall into a very shallow sleep. And shallow sleep does not clean your brain. It does not allow for memory consolidation, and it does not allow for autophagy, which is the process by which your brain takes out the garbage, and you do not want a brain with full trash cans. Sudafed and many decongestant cold medicines are a real problem, and there are many drugs that are stimulants without people realizing that they're stimulants. Talking to your pharmacist or looking at the package, which is called which I'm referring to the FDA package insert here, that is extremely detailed, and you can go through the side effects there. It's a little bit of small print, but you can always magnify that nowadays, and it's extremely important. Here's one that I bet many of you miss up on, and that's avoiding anxiety-provoking activities close to bedtime. For some people, bedtime itself becomes anxiety-provoking. They're trapped in an I'm-not-going-to-sleep, oh-my-God loop. That's not good. But watching the news, paying bills before going to bed, reading exciting materials, certainly checking your financial reports or the stock market, if you're a person who follows that, try to avoid having arguments, even if there is an important issue. Try to get to a plan to make a plan. You may not solve the issue, but you have an action plan. We're going to make an appointment with each other to deal with this tomorrow at noon. We're going to have A, B, and C, but something that puts it to bed for the night. Also, a little bit of self-hypnosis doesn't hurt. Reminding yourself that I can fall asleep, I can relax. Believe it or not, parts of your brain will actually believe you. If you have disturbing thoughts, write them down and then close the book or the notebook or the journal or whatever, or put them in a box. But write them down. You've put them there now. You can, they're out of your head. And whatever's bothering you, again, make a plan for when you're going to deal with it. There are lots of breathing exercises, many apps on your phone that you can use that will walk you through a relaxation ritual. These things actually do help. I do want to emphasize, if you're going to do anything on your phone, you should be wearing amber-colored glasses when you do this. these amber glasses will absorb all of the blue light coming from your phone, and no, clear glasses that you buy online that say they do that don't. The filters that say they do that don't. They get the far blue, but they don't get all of the blue. And believe me, you need to get all of the blue to avoid turning off your melatonin. Remember, I talked about orexin, the stay awake hormone. Well, melatonin is the fall asleep hormone. And if you have low levels of that, it's very difficult to get the whole process rolling. Kind of like trying to start a internal combustion engine in really, really cold weather. You must have a sleep schedule and not blow it on the weekends. Having a regular time to sleep and wake up is amazing. If you actually give yourself 8 hours in bed, you may not sleep through all of it, but you can do one of those relaxation. And what I've found extraordinarily helpful myself is to set an alarm for a half an hour before I want to be in bed. That's my get ready for bed. So you start prepping, thinking about, okay, I've got 30 minutes to be in bed. It's like making an appointment with your sleep cycle. And do try to get to bed by 11. Because honestly, if you look at sleep studies, your sleep efficiency, the effectiveness of your memory consolidation, all of those things we can measure show that it's not as helpful to do late hour sleep. That is to say, going to bed at midnight or one, even if you're in bed for 8 hours, it's not as efficient as that hitting that 11 p.m. mark. If you're going to take a nap, don't take it in the late afternoon. If you're drowsy after lunch, fine. You can do like a half an hour or a 45-minute nap at 2, but don't be taking naps at 5 if you're going to try to get to sleep at 11. And don't nap for longer than 45 minutes unless you are either ill or quite sleep-deprived, because you will have a hard time getting your normal cycle back. You'll actually interfere with your cycle. Large meals before bed, not good. You want to give at least 3 hours before going to sleep. And we have an email about that that we'll be getting to later in the show. Try not to drink more than 4 ounces of fluid. If you are taking a lot of pills, you may get up to 8. And I cannot emphasize enough the importance of heat. A hot bath relaxes muscles. If you throw some Epsom salts in there, maybe throw in some lavender oil. You get an alkalizing effect. You get lower cortisol levels from lavender oil in the bathtub. True science fact. You can measure cortisol levels and you can show this, and they have. What about this idea of, well, I just can't fall asleep? Well, if you've been in bed for more than 30 minutes, get up, go into another room, and try a relaxation technique. Also, you need to analyze a little bit why you're having trouble falling asleep. Maybe you need a sound isolation, or maybe you need to get some duct tape and put tape over all the little red lights in your room, all the little blue lights too. And there's so many devices in my bedroom, the speakers for the television are there. The little lantern I keep in there is dinging. You need not to have that light. I really recommend, if you're going to have a light at night to read, for example, which I do in the middle of the night, it works quite well. I have a red headlight. It's something that astronomers use, and they're very inexpensive. They don't blow your dark adaptation, but they also give you enough light to read. And you have to read paper, of course, if you're going to do this, or use the amber glasses if you're going to use a tablet or your phone. If you're awakening early because of light, then you need some kind of sleep mask. And again, we talked about journaling and writing down. If you're having early wake-ups with recurrent thoughts or recurrent worries, journal it. That doesn't work. Counsel it. 3 a.m. to 5 a.m. waking can be a sign of depression, but you're usually going to have other things like depressed mood, a loss of pleasure in routine things, in decreased energy. I mean, there's usually more than just the sleep factor with depression. But using a dimmer, keeping the reading light low, using the glasses make a big difference. I've seen some experts say put the glasses on at sundown when it's supposed to be sundown. Sometimes that can work for people. If you don't have teenage children who will make terrible fun of you, then that might be a strategy. But keeping the light down in the bedroom while during sleep, keeping if there's noises, I have a lot of patients who tell me, oh, well, my dog has to get up in the middle of the night to pee. And I'm like, no, they don't. Your dog needs some pee pads. If the dog's going to be, and you need, and the dog needs not to be able to scratch on your door. And you can figure this out. You can figure out how your animals are not going to wake you up in the middle of the night. And believe me, your animals will still love you. Keeping the temperature a bit cool, as according to some experts, is very helpful. There are EMF testers. You may want to check for around your bed. There is some pretty solid placebo data showing that high amounts of EMF can interfere with sleep. And I don't have the numbers on this, but what they try to say is cell phones, computers, about 8 feet away. And if that's possible, if you can stand it, that can work. And electric blankets or electric heating pads are potentially also going to interfere with sleep. If you use one and you're having trouble sleeping, go get yourself a comforter and try that instead. There are, of course, another thing that I want to mention. I've already talked about light quite a bit, but if you really are having trouble, if you're a shift worker, if you have been traveling and you're having trouble reestablishing, using bright light in the morning. Now, most mornings, bright light is free. You go and sit next to a window. There are 10,000 lux bright light devices. There's also, I have an app on my phone that measures the amount of lux, which is the units of basically photons. And you want 10,000, you can figure out which way, where to sit and which way to face using your handy dandy smartphone. And you can also buy headsets which provide that amount of light, and they don't provide it directly to the they provide it to your peripheral vision, so you can actually still read while wearing those. So I think we've covered all of my helpful hints for sleep. And I do have a handout which I can share with you. You will have to send me an email to askdrdon.com. And that way you do that is go to that website and click on the contact us and request the Better Sleep handout. And I will share that with you. Staying on the topic of sleep for just a moment. Did you know that sleep can affect your take on a vaccination? It can have a pretty substantial effect. There was one study where volunteers slept for just 4 hours a night for 6 days before they were vaccinated. And then there was a control group. And those who were sleep deprived had only half the antibody response to their flu vaccine 10 days after the shot compared to people who were sleeping as much as they wished prior to the vaccination. Turns out it's not just sleep. Mood is a substantial variation. There's a lot of variation. Some of it's genetic, and in fact, particularly for certain vaccines, for example, with measles, studies of fraternal, that is to say, non-identical twins, show that about 90% of the variation in antibody response to measles is due to genes, which is fascinating. It's different for something like mumps, where the variation in antibody response is less than half as great. And other research points to the microbiome. One study in 2023 looked at people receiving the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine and what kind of antibody response they had. They found that those who had a larger abundance of a beneficial gut bacteria called Bifidobacterium adolescentis, which is associated with eating a Mediterranean diet, lots of vegetables, lots of grain, low processed food, not too much meat. They maintain their vaccine protection much longer, even 6 months after their second dose of vaccine, very high. Other studies have shown links between microbes that are known to keep the gut healthy and things like cholera vaccine and tetanus vaccine. So this isn't just a one-off. This is probably quite real. Antibiotics, of course, deplete the gut microbiome. It comes back eventually. But in one 2019 studies, taking antibiotics for 5 days resulted in a 10,000-fold reduction in the bacteria in the gut. Yes, we know that. But people who got antibiotics had a much, much lower antibody response to flu vaccine than control people. What's the lesson here? Wait for a couple of weeks of after taking any antibiotics to get your flu shot. That's a take-home, folks. Let me repeat that. If you're going to get a flu shot and you have to take antibiotics for a bladder infection, for example, wait 2 weeks. Maybe eat some yogurt. Maybe eat some grain. And maybe eat more vegetables, especially root vegetables, by the way. This will help get you back your microbiome, and therefore you get your good immune response and a better take on the flu shot. You can follow up, however. One study showed that using lactobacillus probiotics twice a day for 28 days after vaccination significantly increased levels of antibodies. And this is in a human study, but there's also a mouse study. And they found that it helped the rodent's immune response after a COVID shot. We do not have COVID data in humans. While we're on it, by the way, if it's been more than a year since you got a COVID shot, I want to ask you why you don't just go get another one. Now, if your answer is, well, I had a bad reaction, okay, I can, as long as you've been vaccinated, I can handle that. But realistically, wear a mask. Don't give away all your masks. If you haven't gotten a vaccine within the last year, you really probably should be wearing a mask in crowded public places where people are yelling, and who wants to do that, right? Okay, I think we've got a phone call. I'm going to cut to that. Hello, this is Dr. Mutika.
Yes, I have a question about SIBO. Why do you use erythromycin?
Okay, I'll answer that. Erythromycin, one of its major side effects is diarrhea, and that's one of the reasons that we don't use it very much anymore. Instead, we use something like Biaxin or Zithromax, which are close cousins and have the same attack on the ribosome that the erythromycin does. But erythromycin actually has an ability to amplify something that's called the colon cleansing response. So the first question I ask when I'm confronted with SIBO is, why does this person have SIBO? Normal intestines shouldn't be able to get small intestinal bacterial overgrowth because there are all of these mechanisms that prevent it, starting with your gastric acid. So does this person not make enough gastric acid? Do they have achlorhydria? Do they have are they so stressed out that they're suppressing their stomach's ability to make gastric acid? The second question I ask is, what about their history? Have they had surgery? Have they had a banding? Have they had obesity surgery? Have they had intestinal surgery or a major car accident? Have they ever had a bowel obstruction? Things like that, because there are sometimes little connections called fistula that form between the small intestine and the large intestine. And that represents a back door into the small intestine that can cause chronic and persistent and recurrent SIBO. So there's...
Which dosage do you use for the erythromycin for the...
If I'm going to treat it, I treat it with a comprehensive plan. I don't just use erythromycin. But if you let me, I will tell you at the end, however, I will tell you the dosage I use. But the reason that I'm going to go through this is so everybody else can understand that this is a thing. Those are the two main causes, but some people actually have a loose colon. So if their ileocecal valve, which is the same valve, you have a pyloric valve at the bottom of your stomach that lets gloops of food out a little bit at a time. If your stomach dumps everything out entirely, you're going to get something called dumping syndrome, which is massive gas and massive diarrhea. Well, if the ileocecal valve isn't working and isn't staying closed most of the time, then the bacteria in your colon, which are 10,000 times more bacteria in your colon than your small intestine, just ooze up there. And hey, there's lots of food. So they give you gas and they give you the cramping and the other things that are associated with SIBO, often completely confused with irritable bowel syndrome. They are distinct entities, but SIBO can masquerade as irritable bowel syndrome. Getting back to the erythromycin, some people just don't clean their intestines well overnight. And what the erythromycin does is it causes a series of contractions starting at the top of the small intestine, and just like wringing out a damp washcloth so it'll dry out faster, it wrings out the intestines. Just think about a snake or an earthworm, okay? Those peristaltic rings that tighten up and close and flow down the earthworm as it moves. Well, imagine that going through your entire intestine. It's supposed to happen in the middle of the night. And if you take the erythromycin at bedtime at about between 200 and 300 milligrams, I did say I would let you know the dose, that can increase that. But this is not a infection. It's just like when you get mold in your bathroom, your bathroom is not infected with mold. So what you need to do is you need to figure out why you don't have it. You probably need to be taking some apple cider vinegar with every meal and with every snack, or betaine hydrochloride or something to raise your stomach acid.
Are you aware of Mark Pimentel's latest research? And he says that they've proven that SIBO is not caused by PPI, by the lack of stomach acid.
I didn't say anything about PPIs. I said low stomach acid. There's lots of
proton pump inhibitors. Well, cause low stomach acid.
Okay, yes, but there are other things that cause stomach acid. When someone uses the word prove, that's almost already not a very scientific statement. I certainly would love to read the actual published study and look at the methods section and see what they were actually testing. But you can't say that a study that fails to show an association between proton pump inhibitors and SIBO proves that stomach acid is not involved. That's not how evidence works. So if you're seeking to challenge the concept of erythromycin and increasing stomach acid as treatments for SIBO, I'm not quite sure what your goal is here.
Well, no, I guess I'm a little confused about, because when I watch Mark Pimentel, he says, right, do not take HCL and do not raise stomach acid, because that the methane eats it and it actually creates more methane SIBO, that it actually feeds the fire.
I think
he's been saying this.
Well, not, it sounds like he's got a YouTube channel or something. Is that right?
No, he does not. He works for Cedars-Sinai Medical Center.
So how are you? How is he saying this?
How are you listening to him? YouTube stations.
So he gets interviewed.
He gets interviewed and he does speeches sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At Cedars-Sinai Hospital, from the hospital itself.
Right.
And this is what he's been saying.
Okay. Like, I'd like to see his evidence, because it goes contrary to a lot of other evidence. So when evidences collide,
he's aware of this, but this is his newest research has shown this. He says.
All right. If you can find a published paper by this guy that says that, you can send that to me. You can just go to my website, askdrdon.com, and you can send me a reference, and I'll read the methods and decide whether I think it's a legitimate paper. But that's all I can commit to. I can't play. Yeah. I can't play. What about, you know, what about this guy who says this thing, who's got this credential? That's not how it works.
Okay. Well, I just.
Yeah, so if you want to try to like look at the end of those YouTubes, maybe they have a bibliography where they actually have a list, you know, that
I
flashes
think it's the
up.
Imagine study is what it was called.
You'd have to try to find it for me and send it to me. It's not something I'm going to go do for you.
They did endoscopies of the microbiome in the small intestine, and they actually DNA'd, you know, thousands of people, and this is one of the things they found.
I'm not sure what they found, but
they found that the name of the bacteria is, and that it would cause any different types of SIBO.
Okay, well, that's legitimate. So, there's nothing wrong with that, but you'll have to show me how it disproves anything I said, offers evidence against it, because proof is one of those elusive things. But
well,
I'm
no,
happy. I keep an open mind. And I'm happy to be informed and educated, but I don't think it's possible for us to do this right now on the basis of the information that you can give me.
That's okay. That's valid. I can't prove anything. I mean, I do see him being interviewed by Mark Hyman and Chris Kresser and people who are really into naturopathic stuff.
And they have a discussion.
So that's been discussed several times, and he's very adamant about it. And I don't know that they're changing their practice, but they seem to be all people that respect Mark Pimentel's opinion on this particular topic.
I have no basis to either respect or disrespect it at this time.
Okay.
Being on somebody's YouTube doesn't necessarily prove legitimacy of the statements. There's lots of statements that I read in the medical literature or in, in books, and then I go and actually check it out, and it's an assertion, but it isn't necessarily proved, and it isn't necessarily generalizable beyond the group in which the study was done, and so it kind of depends on everything that you can't tell me right now, but send me a paper. I'm happy to look at it. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm just concerned about that erythromycin dose being.
Well, then don't
so high
take it.
Since it's autotoxic.
Don't take it. You don't have to take it.
Mark Pimentel saying do 50 milligrams of.
My dear, I'm going to sign off. Okay. Send me an article. Okay. That would be interesting.
Sorry.
We're going to turn to another sort of issue. And you may think that the current court case that's before the Supreme Court around mifepristone is about abortion, but it's actually not. It's about this obscure condition, this obscure thing called standing. And briefly, this is about mifepristone, which was approved by the FDA in 2000. And at that time, it was studied, it was looked at for safety, it's been tracked for safety. And then between 2016 and 2023, based on years of data, including when they relaxed the in-person dispensing requirement, nothing bad happened. We have all this data showing that nothing bad happened, and they had to change the rules. That meant extending the period in which the drug could be taken up to 10 weeks. Nothing bad happened. Removing multiple in-person office visit requirements. Nothing bad happened. And so that elimination in 2023 of the requirement that the drug be taken in person in a physician's office, that was huge for women, but it also led to, oh my God, a huge reaction from the people who seek to limit women's reproductive agency. And whatever you think about that, that's not the subject of this discussion. But that Texas court's decision to take mifepristone off the market because of because it might be dangerous, even though there's substantial evidence, completely circumvents the actual rationale for Dobbs. Now, the Dobbs decision said, I want to emphasize this, folks, it said, it's not the job of the Supreme Court of the United States to decide about abortion. That's up to the states, and we're going to let the states decide. But this Texas court, this taking mifepristone off the market for the entire nation, that does exactly the opposite. It affects patients and physicians in every state. And the stakes are not, don't just stop with abortion. It stops, it's important for the FDA. It threatens the status of our gold standard for independent scientific review. In this case, if this case is approved by the Supreme Court, it creates a precedent that could allow almost anyone, no matter what their relationship is to the drug. Now, this could include other drug companies with competing drugs. It could lead to, can you imagine, like Pfizer sues Merck, Merck sues, you know, I'm trying to think of another drug company. And you get the idea. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on all the drug company names. I guess I blocked them out too much. Anyway, drug companies suing each other for competitive reasons, ideologic opponents, like, for example, I don't believe abortion should be allowed, political actors of any kind, just to make noise and to get attention. It could create especially if the drug is a settled, approved drug that's essentially generic. We, you know, 10, 20, 30 years later, you can come back and attack the drug because you want to. It means that a federal judge is going to second guess the independent judgment of the scientific experts at the FDA. And so it risks politicizing the entire drug approval process well beyond anything that's legitimate. Where's that judge's MD? All right. I'm not trying to judge the law. You don't try to be a doctor. Federal law usually restricts who can sue and the period that suits can be bought. And these principles are fundamental. This is what the standing means. Litigation should only be brought by those who are actually harmed. But in this case, the plaintiffs are physicians and a medical association that do not even provide abortion services or prescribe mifepristone. They literally have no skin in this game except their ideological or religious opinion. They claim that their practices are burdened by patients who come to see them with complications after taking mifepristone. And yet, those complications are really thin on the ground. And any physician could sue for any drug, even if they have nothing to do with the drug, even if they've never prescribed it, because they could also say, well, someone might come to me with a medical complication, and no drug is 100% free of complications, so therefore, all drugs could be challenged in the Supreme Court. Is this any way to run a healthcare system? Well, you bet it isn't, in my opinion. Okay, our next story is about how vaginal dryness can be fatal. Does that sound like an exaggeration? Well, here's some interesting data. First of all, there's something called GSM. We love in medicine to give things acronyms. It stands for genitourinary syndrome of menopause. And that's not just vaginal dryness. It's also drying out and thinning. Turns out that those bladder symptoms, the thinning of the urethra, the thinning of the bladder, that affects a lot of women. It also causes a lot of expense. This is something that probably people don't realize. One of the things that kills older women is recurrent urinary tract infections. Because that bladder skin is thin, the bacteria are able to inflame it and then squeeze through the tight junctions that would normally keep them out and get into the bloodstream. Urinary tract infections account for 7 million visits and hospitalizations annually. It's 25% of all infections in older people, and one-third of the total United States Medicare expenditure is around urinary tract infections, many of them leading to sepsis, and that sepsis bacteria in the bloodstream leading to death. And we've got a treatment. Vaginal hormones have existed since the 1970s, but we're not using them for these bladder symptoms. Everyone is freaked out about estrogen. But when you put these hormones in the vagina, they do not increase the level of systemic hormones in the bloodstream at the uses, at the levels that are used. In fact, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology says in women who have breast cancer or who have had breast cancer, as long as blood levels are monitored, they can use these products. The only exception is women who are on active aromatase inhibitor for breast cancer, because there you're trying to zero out estrogen completely, and we don't have data on safety in that circumstance. Urinary tract infections kill people. And by the way, waking up multiple times in the middle of the night of the night messes up your sleep and contributes, because that sleep is so important in prevention of dementia as we age. It's really important to rethink this. My personal favorite is vaginal estrogen, but I like DHEA, which is, I'd say it's like Flomax for women. We give Flomax to our men to help with their prostate issues. DHEA in the vagina should, in my opinion, be as common as Flomax in the elder male. It prevents urinary tract infections. It actually helps a little bit with libido. It reduces pain with sex. It thickens the walls of the bladder and the urethra and lowers the risk of infection. So just, you know, talk to your doctor about getting some vaginal DHEA. It is available by prescription. It is not a scary thing to take, and it makes a big difference within 3 or 4 weeks for patients. And I think that's pretty amazing. Hello, this is Dr. Dawn. You're on the air.
Yes, Aileen calling.
Hi, Aileen.
Some time ago, you referred about the lion's mane mushroom, and a neighbor friend of mine, I can't remember how she acquired it, a powder form.
Mm-hmm. There's a little shop down in Santa Cruz where you can buy that powder.
I'm not. Where did you say?
It's on Laurel near Center, and it has mushrooms in the name. I'm not remembering the exact.
Well, I
name
know
of the
mushroom
company.
Place, but she got it somewhere else.
Well,
they didn't have
it. Well, the mushroom place has it though.
Oh,
and it's, you know, I've checked their prices. They're relatively inexpensive, and it's. You just go in through the door.
Well, I tried it and took it.
Yeah? But how did it go? Did you find it helpful?
It did not.
Well, how long did you take it?
Well, over a month of the whole package I finished.
And what were you expecting?
And it didn't, well, to help with remembering dreams.
Oh, well, that wouldn't be something I would expect it to necessarily be helpful for.
Well, I thought you mentioned.
Well, I said it helps with, it can help with memory, but not specifically with dreams, I don't think.
Oh, okay.
So that, you know, dreams are funny. It depends on how you sleep, but I do have a suggestion to help you with remembering dreams. It's this. Take a bunch of index cards or a little notebook and a pen and put it by your bedside. And before you go to bed.
I do that.
Before you go to bed, you say to yourself, I'm going to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you wake up in the morning, even a little tiny fragment, even if it's just a quick little image, write that down.
Oh, yeah.
And I have found that over time, you can sort of train your subconscious to remember your dreams better if you're diligent about writing down these little fragments. I have gotten less good at this lately. I have been less diligent about the fragments, and I find that my dream recall has fallen off. So it is... Mm. It is not, it doesn't permanently change. You actually have to keep at it.
Well, I walk and walk and walk and walk, and I try to get into the habit of, I will remember my dream.
All right. Well, good luck. Good luck, my dear.
Bye. One more thing, please.
We got another caller, so real quick.
This, someone, an unopened bottle, people put things in the laundry room, food and things. And this, it was such a horrible taste. Alive, ancient mushroom elixir, root beer with reishi, chaga, and turkey tail vegetables. It was just...
Well, mushrooms are pretty bitter, and I think I've seen either that product or something like it.
Mm.
And knowing what I know about mushrooms, I was like, yeah, that's going to taste pretty funky, and it sounds like it did. Okay, my dear, I've got another caller waiting, so I'm going to sign you off.
Okay.
Bye-bye. All right. Hello, you're on the air.
Great. Hey, what kind of estrogen do you suggest for adrenaline, and can we get it at a health food store?
No, you can't. It's a prescription only. And DHEA, which is dihydroepiandrosterone, I think is a little bit better. But if you're going to use estrogen, you would want to use estradiol. And
great, thank you.
All right, very good. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Let's get a little science-y, shall we, at the end of the show? Animal cloning, right? This has been around since, gosh, the 70s, I think, was when Dolly was cloned. And it's become very, very common to do cloning, but cloning is difficult. The easiest animals to clone are cattle. And so what is a clone? A clone is where you take an adult cell from an animal and you peel it out of the cell. So you have just the nucleus, and you take that nucleus and you drop it into an ovum, an egg, from which you've removed the nucleus. And you can get, in the case of cattle, you can clone about 5 to 20% of the time. The other times you've taken that ova, you implant it in a uterus, and it just doesn't grow. Things don't go right. And when they've studied about this, you know, most species, it's 1% to 3% of implant where you can get a viable newborn. Nobody has cloned and I'm wrong about Dolly. It was 1996 when Dolly was cloned. For some reason, I thought it was earlier than that. But this method of cloning where you take a somatic cell and you drop it into an ovum is missing something very critical. It's missing the sperm. And that's really important because the sperm contains the instructions for making the placenta. So the placenta is the organ by which the fetus is attached to the uterine wall. It acts as the filter, and the umbilical cord connects the fetus to the placenta, and then the placenta filters the blood and extracts things and keeps other things out. And it grows from both the maternal cells in this fertilized egg in the blastocyst, but it also grows from cells in the outer layer. So in a normal embryo, you have essentially two layers that form. The inner cell layer becomes the monkey or the dog or the human or the whatever. And the outer cell layer gets a collection on one side of it, and that forms the placenta. Recent researchers have realized is that there's a difference in that tropoblast from clones that was why they didn't take. The placentas just didn't work properly in most of the clones and still don't. When you look down genetically at those placentas from clones, what you find is that four genes in the tropoblasts had their imprinting removed. That's the ticket. That imprinting comes from the sperm. It's a strange phenomenon. It happens in just a handful of genes. In imprinting, whether a gene works or not depends on which parent it was inherited from. And a lot of imprinted genes are active in the placenta. Now, why this is an interesting thing. It's the one hypothesis that I think you'll find particularly interesting is that it's the battle of the sexes. So genes bearing the father's imprint, that is to say from the sperm, want to encourage the transfer of as much energy and resources from the mother to the fetus as possible, while those bearing the mother's imprint want to limit the amount of food and calcium and glucose that's given to the fetus so that the mother it literally isn't eaten alive from the inside. And so there's this dynamic balance between the mother cells not wanting to give up too much and the father cells wanting to take it all. Upset that balance by not having the male imprints there, and the placentas don't feed the fetus well enough for it to grow. So essentially, you need that arm wrestling contest for proper gestation. So researchers now have found that if they take the inner cell masses, that is to say, what will become the fetus from cloned blastocysts, and then inject them into other blastocysts, which were created from normal fertilized cells, that it had their inner cell mass removed. Essentially, what you've done is you've created a vessel. So you've basically done take the cell, empty out the nucleus, put another nucleus in there, let that grow. Now, empty out the bag of cells from the inner cell mass, put your cloned inner cell mass in there, and stand back and let it happen, because now the placental imprinting is still intact. So one researcher in China is actually managing to, I wouldn't call it mass producing, but he's succeeded with the holy grail here of being able to clone monkeys, male rhesus monkeys. Monkeys are the mainstay of non-human primate research. And if we can do genetic modification on them and then produce enough of them to actually do science on, that's going to be a major, major scientific breakthrough, something that I personally am very excited to see happen. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.